I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that is, boy, is it in the news? It's current, it is controversial, it is important, and it's probably, if it's not on your phone, I bet it's on your children or grandchildren's phone. We're going to be talking about TikTok and the information wars, the importance of social media in today's society, and the strategic implications of social media. And I'm joined for the conversation today by Michael Sobolik. Michael is Senior Fellow in Indo-Pacific Studies at the American Foreign Policy Council. We are delighted to have him with us because he is a specialist in American and Chinese grand strategy and is going to help us think today about social media and TikTok in light of larger strategic issues which are driving and shaping that conversation. Michael, besides being senior fellow, is an author of a really terrific book that I want to encourage our readers and listeners to get a hold of. It's called Countering China's Great Game, A Strategy for American Dominance. Again, that's a terrific book. I'm sure it's sold. Michael, I think wherever people can buy books, they can buy your book.
So thanks for promoting that. On Tax Day, April 15th, that is the day that the book launches out into the world. So it's available for pre-order right now. But for any of your listeners who are expecting a federal refund or a state refund, you can turn around, use that money and buy the book. But if you want to buy it early, you can pre-order.
Well, that's terrific. So let me encourage all our listeners to pre-order that. Again, it's called Countering China's Great Game, A Strategy for American Dominance. Michael Sobolik, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Everybody's heard of TikTok, but I don't think everybody of our all of our listeners know what it is and why it has become so important in the conversation about social media.
TikTok matters when you talk about social media because it's unlike other social media platforms. Oftentimes, when you hear members of Congress talk about regulating social media, the conversation will veer quickly into privacy, into protecting data. All of that matters, and it's a problem that is certainly relevant to TikTok, but it's equally relevant to other platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and others. Those platforms are owned by American companies. TikTok is unique in this way. It is not owned by an American company. Its parent company is called ByteDance. It is domiciled in China, in the People's Republic of China. And by virtue of that, the Chinese Communist Party, the single political entity that exercises a monopoly of control inside of China, has the ability to leverage TikTok in ways that are unique and potentially dangerous for the United States, not only when it comes to data security, but particularly to propaganda, to disinformation, to leveraging political narratives and censoring political narratives in the interest of Beijing. So it's a very unique threat when we talk about social media, and the focus on Capitol Hill reflects that.
I think a lot of parents and grandparents and maybe some of the young people who are listening who have TikTok on their phones would say, oh, come on. It's just another social media app. It has fun stuff on there, fun videos, interesting things that I can watch and share and be part of. How could it really be that bad?
A lot of people will call TikTok a Trojan horse. And the analogy kind of gets to that sensibility of, oh, shucks, it's just a harmless app where you have weird, awkward dances. And it's interesting, if you, at the risk of sounding like a nerd, if you go back and actually read Virgil's account of the Trojan horse as it's entering the city of Troy and the Greeks are feigning their retreat, you see some similar contextual clues that align with the TikTok scenario here in the United States. As they were wheeling the Trojan horse into the city walls of Troy, Virgil writes about how you could actually hear the clanging of the soldiers and their weapons inside of the belly of this massive horse. And yet you had all these young children dancing around the horse because they thought it was so cool and so wonderful. And the analogies to TikTok are kind of eerie in that the concerns of TikTok are known. It's not like this is a new revelation. National security experts have been warning about TikTok for years. And I think this is where simple direct communication is really needed. Because when I talk to former senior officials in the National Security Council in the previous administration, in the Trump administration, I've had some one-on-one conversations with them, they characterize TikTok as the greatest asymmetric threat that America has faced since COVID-19, which really puts the seriousness of this conversation into relief. And here's why. There are somewhere between 140 to 170 million Americans on TikTok. That is not quite, but almost half of the American population. So just stop and think about that in and of itself. Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party control an app, one of, if not the most popular social media apps in the United States. And Americans who use TikTok are increasingly using it not only for entertainment, but for news. This affords the CCP an unrivaled advantage to shape the perceptions of Americans on any issues, but importantly, how they view China, how they view current events, and to mold that sensibility in a way that advances the CCP's interests and not America's interests. That's what makes TikTok so insidious.
So is it too strong to call TikTok China's Trojan horse?
I think it's accurate. I think it's accurate to call it the CCP's Trojan horse because it's exactly what it is. And Xi Jinping has been speaking for years about the necessity for China to secure discourse power, to control political narratives, not just inside of China, but all over the world. I think a lot of us are really familiar with the Great Firewall inside of China, which is a defensive measure for the CCP to censor and control information and political speech inside of China. But there's an offensive component for what the party is doing as well. And Xi Jinping has been focusing for years about the need for the Chinese Communist Party to leverage the internet to win those narrative battles about China and to shape discourse and perceptions of China. And Chinese state media, the People's Daily and Xinhua in particular, have identified TikTok as one of those such sites where that's important to do. So TikTok is one of the greatest foreign policy instruments that the CCP has.
Can you talk a little bit more about, I mean, that's really fascinating and as you're describing it, frightening. But can you talk a little bit more about the connection between TikTok and China's grand strategy? Because you are an expert in sort of Chinese grand strategy and American grand strategy. What's the larger strategic goal of China? And how does TikTok fit into that? Say a little bit more about that.
So if you zoom out and ask the biggest questions of foreign policy, what's a nation's interest? What are their means or capabilities and how can they match those two together? You get into a really dangerous picture when it comes to Beijing. The overriding strategic ambition for Xi Jinping and for the Chinese Communist Party is to displace the United States as the most powerful country in the world, and in so doing, to make the world safe for authoritarianism and their own imperial interests. And China is not often described as an imperialist power. For obvious reasons, we do
I think I would just say that I think a lot of people would say, I don't see them invading other countries. I don't see them taking territory. How are they imperial?
Sure. So China, some historical context is helpful here. The first Chinese dynasty in 221 BC, then you fast forward to the final Chinese dynasty in 1912 AD, China expanded territorially by a factor of four. And if you look at the history of China's warfare during its dynastic period, to be sure, some of those battles were defensive wars, but a great many of them were offensive ones. And the region in China right now, where they're executing an ongoing genocide against Uyghur Muslims and other minorities in the western territory of Xinjiang, which has gotten a lot of press attention in the United States, that territory was brought into China by imperialist domination and effectively colonialism. And we look at China today primarily as an ideological threat. It's authoritarian. There's communist ideology that subsumes the entirety of the CCP. But we don't get the full picture if we don't look at Chinese foreign policy through history, because this is a nation that has expanded not only through territorial expansion and aggression, but through economic coercion and political control. And that's what you see the CCP doing today. Some of your listeners may have heard of the Belt and Road Initiative. Others maybe haven't. The Belt and Road Initiative, or the BRI, is essentially an economic plan of imperialism for the CCP today to leverage its economic power to shift the political and strategic orientation of Southeast Asia, of Africa, the Middle East, Europe, the Pacific Islands, Latin America, and our own hemisphere away from the United States and towards China. So China, no, they're not territorially aggressive in the way that Peter the Great was or Napoleon or anything like that, no. But they do have territorial ambitions on Taiwan, for sure. And there is good reason to believe that China wouldn't stop at Taiwan if they were to get Taiwan. But what we do know for certain is they are using economics to change the world and exert dominance over sovereign countries.
And how does TikTok and its ability to shape the narrative in America aid in that quest for them?
In two ways. Externally, in an offensive way, the CCP realizes that when it is trying to exert influence in democracies, you can only go so far with strong-arming a democratic regime, because ultimately the government in question is accountable to its citizens in a way that the CCP is not accountable to the Chinese people, because it's an authoritarian country. But in democracies, you actually have to get the will of the people to govern and keep the will of the people to govern. And China understands this. The CCP understands this. So what they have to do is infiltrate democracies and use democratic systems and turn them against each other. It's very much like a virus where you turn the body against itself. And that's what China is trying to do with democracies, turn democratic institutions to work against democracies and not for them. And TikTok is a fantastic and scary example of how effective that can be, because it is incredibly popular. It's one of the most popular apps in the world. And it is also addictive. Some national security experts will call TikTok digital fentanyl, and they do that for a reason. It's one of the most addictive apps around, and it's because of the algorithm and how precisely it's tailored and programmed. And China has already used TikTok to shape public opinion in democracies. We saw this in the wake of Hamas attacking Israel on October 7th last year, and how pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian content skyrocketed on TikTok and pro-Israel content was depressed and in some cases censored. We've seen content about Taiwan, Tiananmen Square, the Uyghurs, Tibet, all of it censored on TikTok to shape perceptions. Again,
can I ask about that particular thing? So for example, yeah. So some of our listeners who don't have TikTok as an app out of choice, or they just, that's not their thing. If they wanted to post something, how does TikTok work? So take, for example, Tiananmen Square. Let's say it was the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. They wanted to post something on there. What would happen?
One of two things would happen. Either your post will be allowed to publish, but the algorithm will hide it from reaching the screens of other TikTok users. It'll depress and in effect shadow ban the content from reaching the amount of screens and the amount of users any other content would have otherwise. The other way that TikTok can censor and leverage speech is a lot more aggressive. Last year, during congressional hearings on TikTok, a member of Congress was questioning TikTok's CEO, and they said point blank, "I know for a fact that the former basketball player, Enes Kanter Freedom, who was turned into a human rights activist, opened a TikTok account and tried to post content about Tiananmen Square and other sensitive issues to the CCP, and his account was locked down, and he was unable to post at all." So in some cases, they can be a lot more direct and a lot more aggressive with how they police it. So it's whatever way they go about it, the effect is the same. You are withholding content that is sensitive to the party.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
And is there the flip side, which is the party itself will put out content?
Either put out content or boost favorable content, yes. And this is what we saw in October of last year when Hamas attacked Israel. The pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian content on TikTok skyrocketed in a way that was unequal to any other social media app. There were some studies that compared it to Instagram, to Facebook, and to others. And the disparity on TikTok was noticeable. And there were also some corresponding studies done on, well, hey, if I try to post about Tibet, Tiananmen Square, or Taiwan on Instagram versus TikTok, what does it look like? Very similar result. A lot more balanced on Instagram, not balanced at all on TikTok.
Fascinating. So if we take a step back then and we say, all right, this is a real problem for American national security and foreign policy, as you've outlined here. Your book is subtitle is A Strategy for American Dominance. I think a lot of our listeners are going to say, okay, so what do we do about it? What do we do in the immediate sense of TikTok? But more broadly, what should our strategy be?
To go on offense. I say that because I was a congressional staffer for 5 years in the United States Senate, and I left my time on Capitol Hill with one big takeaway. Congress is a very reactive institution. And by design, it's kind of supposed to be reactive constitutionally because members in the House of Representatives are running on 2-year election cycles. You have to be responsive to your constituents. But that also comes at a price strategically. Congress is really good at putting fires out and recognizing problems that others have created, or in some cases that Congress has created, and trying to fix it. What Congress is not really good at doing is being proactive strategically in foreign policy, finding a weakness or vulnerability in an adversary and exploiting it. So when I left Congress and came to the American Foreign Policy Council and started this book project, my goal was that exactly, to give staffers and policymakers practical policy options to go on the offensive with China. For a simple reason, we're in a Cold War with the CCP, and playing defense is not enough to win a Cold War. You have to identify your adversary's weaknesses to win, and that's what the book does.
Good. Talk a little bit about what you think those weaknesses are and how America can go on offense.
So, two ways. Examining China's foreign policy and countering it around the world, and tracing the roots of that foreign policy back to China and creating problems for the CCP within China. Let's start around the world first. The Belt and Road runs in many cases on corrupt deals, not only between state-owned enterprises and foreign companies, but in some cases with corrupt gangs that are tied to international criminal syndicates tied to China. One of the best steps that the United States ever took with going after the Belt and Road was hitting organized crime in Southeast Asia that was tied to the BRI. And they wrote these sanctions in such a way that in the span of about 3 months, two things happened. Number one, the United States and the Philippines and a number of other countries took out an international crime syndicate tied to China that was using the Belt and Road to advance their illicit activities, and in the process got incredibly bad press for China and for the BRI and made it more difficult for other countries to partner with China along those lines. So one really simple way is have aggressive sanctions that target not only the crime syndicates, but these Chinese companies that are connected to them. So that's one thing. Inside of China is where you can get really interesting really quickly. We've been talking about information and discourse a lot in this conversation so far. The CCP tries to control information because they are an insecure government, because they have no internal legitimacy, unlike the United States and unlike other democracies. One of the things America needs to start doing is to make it more difficult for the CCP to control information within its own borders. The justification that we have for doing that is COVID-19. In 2019 and 2020, when the CCP learned about COVID, they cared more about controlling information about the virus than they cared about stopping the virus. And it became a pandemic and Americans died. So how the CCP handles information within its own borders is not just a human rights issue, it's a national security issue for Americans. And the U.S. government should be doing really creative things to make it more difficult for the party to control information. The strategic benefit of doing that is they have to devote more resources to that at home, which means they're distracted from other foreign policy adventurism and belligerence abroad.
What about defensive measures? There's been a lot of conversation, as you know, in Congress and elsewhere about banning TikTok. What is that possible? Is that feasible? Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea?
Interestingly, the bill going through Congress right now does not ban TikTok. There were bills last year that did ban it. There were others that did not. This bill does not ban TikTok. It mandates a divestment or a separation between TikTok and its CCP-controlled parent company, ByteDance. And that has to happen within 6 months of the bill coming into law. And if within 6 months of that, TikTok is still owned by ByteDance, then there is a prohibition on U.S. tech companies like Apple or Google. And the law would basically say, Apple and Google, you can no longer platform TikTok on your app stores. You cannot post any further updates to the app. You cannot allow any new people to download it. It needs to disappear. So it would be essentially a slow death for TikTok. Users couldn't update it, couldn't maintain the app, and it would just degrade over time. Legally, it's a much cleaner solution than banning it constitutionally. And there's precedence for doing this with other apps too.
So tell, in your opinion, would that separation, that legal separation of TikTok from its Chinese parent company with ties to the CCP, would that be effective?
It would be very effective in protecting Americans from the insidious influence of the CCP on social media. I think it would be very effective. And I think this is where clarity is really helpful. The privacy issues would remain because TikTok would remain a social media company, just like X, Instagram, Facebook, and the others. So you would still, I imagine members of Congress would still have concerns about regulating privacy practices and concerns and data security, but the national security concerns would disappear in that scenario.
What's the situation like in Congress? Is this a bipartisan issue on which you think Republicans and Democrats agree and can agree and come together? Or what's the situation politically in Congress on this?
We're finding out in real time right now, but maybe we can
what
talk
are we
about,
finding out?
Yeah. So like what we've seen so far, again, as a former staffer, that the House of Representatives hasn't exactly cultivated a reputation for effective governance this year. We've had two speakers of the House. There's been a lot of chaos. Not a whole lot of legislation has moved through. However, when it came to this TikTok bill, within 8 days, the bill was introduced, marked up in committee, and passed. And that was not along partisan lines. You had left-wing progressives to right-wing Freedom Caucus members co-sponsor this bill. It passed through committee 50-0, and it passed on the House floor 352 votes to 65 or something like that. Overwhelming margins of support of Republicans and Democrats in the House. And then after it passed through the House, the White House leaned in, publicized its support, and encouraged the Senate to move quickly, which was really interesting. The Senate is the question mark right now. And the Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, has been quiet about his intentions toward the bill. The Committee of Jurisdiction is the Commerce Committee. The chairwoman is a Democrat, Maria Cantwell. The ranking member is my old boss in the Senate, Ted Cruz from Texas. And they are evaluating the bill. They have not taken a position. Other senators have. I'm keeping track of all 100 senators and trying to get my best guess on how this could go. I'm counting 36 easy yeses and about 20 easy no's, which leaves roughly half of the Senate up for grabs. And I think this vote is really going to come down to how quickly it moves, if it moves at all. And if it does go up for a vote, this is the type of bill that for most members will be difficult to oppose if they have to vote on it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that because you said there might be 20 no votes in the Senate. There were 65 or so no votes in the House. Those who are voting no on a bill, for example, that you clearly support, what's their rationale for the no vote? Is it that the bill goes too far or that the bill doesn't go far enough?
It's mixed, depending on who you talk to, which is so strange. So the bill, it's not this sweeping piece of legislation like we saw last year with other bills that came through the Senate. It's also not just a ban on TikTok. It's a divestment requirement that has other provisions that go beyond TikTok. So it's kind of like a Goldilocks approach, I guess. They try to thread the needle with this. But you have some members saying it's too specific. We should not single out TikTok or name a company in a piece of legislation. Then you have other senators saying this is too broad. We need to just focus on TikTok. So again, it's Congress. There are so many cooks in the kitchen. All of them have their own recipes and just their own ingredients they want to cook with. So we'll see.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to watch. And this has been such a terrific overview of the situation, the insight. And if for our listeners, what can they do personally to address the issue?
So as a think tanker, my days of being on the inside of politics are behind me. But whenever I talk to people who have questions about how to get involved, I think a few things. Number one, whatever you think about the bill, whether you support it or you oppose it, it's always a good thing to engage politically and reach out to your member of Congress. Again, as a former staffer, I can tell you those calls matter. And it might feel like they don't, but trust me, they do. And I would also really encourage anybody listening to not listen to just one source of information. This is so important, not just for the TikTok issue. It's important as we enter this information age, especially with deep fakes and artificial intelligence. It is so crucial to triple check and quadruple check the information you see coming across your phone and your computer screens, and to have multiple different inputs of information and news that you are getting from different political voices. The further down you go any rabbit hole, you risk getting a single slice of the truth and missing the whole picture of something. So having a good diversified information and flow is just so important.
Yeah, you're talking about newsfeed, Michael, and the importance of multiple sources. It's also true, right, that news, when you're on your phone and so through social media, it's not neutral. News comes to you in a certain way through a certain algorithm, and that people need to be aware of that.
It's so important that it requires the user to not be passive with how they receive news. In some ways, you have to think of yourself as someone who's on the hunt to find news and not as someone who is receiving the news like you would receive the newspaper delivered to your door. For instance, for me, I have a few outlets that I will always listen to on China reporting. I have the Financial Times up there. I have the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, although they recently axed their China reporting team, so maybe not them as much as previously. But Washington Post has really good China content from time to time as well. And Axios, and for congressional coverage, Punchbowl is great, as is Politico sometimes. So all of these outlets have their slant, their ideological biases. And honestly, that's fine. Every outlet is going to. There's no such thing as a neutral outlet. The important thing is to have a diversified menu that you're getting your news from. And you have to take responsibility to build that for yourself. But the payoff for doing it is well worth it.
Well, that's wise counsel. A very, very thoughtful. Michael, thanks for taking the time to join us today. Again, for our listeners, Michael's book is Countering China's Great Game, A Strategy for American Dominance. Michael Sobolik, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.